I don't know what Mr. Thomas was talking about on Day of Atonement. There's plenty of water up here. It's nice. Hello, everyone. For those of you who are at home and can't see the congregation, there are exactly five people here besides me. No, I'm making that up. There's plenty of people here. But many are on their way. I love that song. It won't be long now. I've always felt like that was our church theme song. I remember... I think it was like the 70s or 80s when it was written, and it was so beautiful. Easy symbolism for all ages to understand. We always end up our Camp Buckeye sing-along with It Won't Be Long Now, because it's a good thing to leave in people's minds. It's just a beautiful concept. Well, are you ready to go? We are, pretty much. There's a few things we have to do tonight. Taya's at home with Charlie, the dog, because Charlie goes to the kennel today, and it just worked out easier that way. So hello, everyone at home. Hi, Taya. How are you? Hi, Charlie. Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy, huh? We'll see if he's listening. I'll find out. But I'm excited. It's nice to ditch everything and light out for the territories, as Huckleberry Finn said at one point. I remember in the old days meaning before I was 40 or so, that it seemed like feast preparations were even a little bit harder. For one thing, the parking lots have improved. People didn't drive very nice cars back then. They were all falling apart and losing parts in the parking lot at church. And it was traditional that 4 or 5 days before the feast, you would look at your car and think, I wonder if that could make it all the way to wherever we're going. And there was a man named Tom Cruise. And Tom Cruise, some of you will remember him, he was around before there was an actor we were aware of named Tom Cruise. So when Tom Cruise, the actor, showed up, he was the imposter as far as we were concerned. But Tom, bless his heart, would lie in the driveway and fix people's cars for days before the feast. I have no idea what his own car was like at that point. I know that his wife used to understandably get upset because they had their own preparations and with three children to get to the feast. But Tom was, he couldn't turn anybody away. And so our cars sometimes mostly made it to the feast and back, and we had our feast stickers, and there were a lot of people going. So on the highway, you would see people and you knew they were going to the feast. And if your car did have troubles or something, there was a good chance that a church person would be along. I mean, that was just the way it was. There were enough people in those days. I remember, did any of you ever meet in Gargus Hall? Yeah, okay. Well, there's a lot of people here who remember Gargus Hall on Route 254 in Lorain. And there was a woman there. They moved here, from Illinois, I believe. And it was, her name was Ruth Ann Cleveland. Easy name to remember, Ruth Ann Cleveland in the Cleveland Church. And Ruth Ann was a wonderful church member. She had a husband named Larry Cleveland. And Larry was not a member, but he was very cooperative. And he would come to church services and he would go to the feasts and things. He wasn't interested in God's way of life at that point. And it was always a big deal to Ruth Ann, and she really wanted him to be part of things. And one day, I think it was in their congregation before us. I don't think it was at Gargus Hall, but she was told the story at Gargus Hall. And Larry was standing there. It was like today, right before the feast. And Larry looked staring out the window and thinking. And Ruth Ann went up to him, and Larry turned to her and said, "This has to be God's church." And Ruth Ann was quite excited. You know, this was something she'd been hoping and praying for a long time. And she said, "Well, what's on your mind? What makes you think so?" And he said, "Well, look out at that parking lot. Those people think they're driving those cars all the way to Big Sandy and back. And it will take a miracle to do that. And if it happens, we know this is God's church." So it wasn't quite what Ruth Ann had in mind. Ironically, they had a daughter named Jean, who is now a grandmother. I think we ran into her at Lake George. And Ruth Ann passed away not that long after. But her husband, Larry, is now part of church act, the church. So it's interesting how life goes on. But I just always remember that. It's hard to keep the feast in 2021. It was hard to keep the feast in 1973, which was the first time I kept it. So I think that means this will be my 49th feast. And that sounds like a lot, but there's people here who have kept the feast more times than that. And there's a person sitting in my house who's kept the feast more times than that. And, you know, some people have been keeping the feast since birth and they have a head start, so they can be younger than I am and have kept the feast for more years. But we get into the, we develop a system for going to the feast because it's just not normal in our society. What's normal is those holidays that we don't mention that people made up and that God does not want us to observe. It's easy to keep those. I mean, if you ask for time off around those holidays, it's not hard. But it's hard. We have to ask for time off. Sometimes people even lose their jobs over keeping the feast. It has happened. We have to endure people not understanding. We have to explain so much to so many people. And we develop our own ways of doing it. In college, it was, I'm going to a church conference. It's a church conference. And that, you know, it was a church conference, but it was the Feast of Tabernacles. But I didn't keep it proudly. I kept it secretly. I didn't. When I was at the feast, I kept it proudly. But the rest of the time, it was quite difficult. I remember, and people, you know, the Feast of Tabernacles is a foreign concept to many people. It's just not normal. I remember my sister, who does not keep the Feast of Tabernacles, but is very much aware of it. We talk about it freely in my family. I'm happy to be able to do that. And they always ask where we're going to the feast. And we always send them a card or something from the feast. But my nephew was probably, well, high school age. And he was hanging around with a bunch of his friends. And Steve wasn't there that day. And they said, "Where's Steve?" And they said, "Oh, he's off keeping the Feast of Tabernacles." And my sister's antennae went up at that point because she'd heard of the Feast of Tabernacles. And somebody said, "What's the Feast of Tabernacles?" And somebody said, "Well, that's Steve's Christmas." And my sister said, "I beg your pardon. The Feast of Tabernacles is not Christmas." And I don't know how much she knew, but she wanted me to know that she had defended the Feast of Tabernacles at that point, and I appreciated it. And you know, someday people will be doing that. It's not Christmas. It's not anything like Christmas. In my own family, my children don't attend. My granddaughter, little two-year-old, will grow up keeping Christmas. That's what she does. Her mother has never been part of our church way of doing things. And someday the granddaughter is going to ask why grandma and grandpa do it the way that they do it, because she's a smart little thing and she'll figure it out. Also beautiful and coordinated and talented, like all grandchildren are, you know. But those days are coming and we're not the normal ones. In the sight of the world, we keep a yearly piece of theater. And I call it theater because we act out with symbols the story of God's plan. But we also act it out in other ways. We act it out with travel. We act it out with temporary dwellings. And it gets us in the right framework to keep God's holy days and to proclaim these things that are actually a part of history already or are going to be a part of history. Now, it's not normal, so we tend to be shy about it, but we do it. I love the travel aspect of things because you get to ditch things and leave them behind. And especially, we didn't go to the feast last year. I understand if people do not go to the feast in this plague, times of plague, or if they have other reasons for not going, but I just love leaving things behind. And it's sort of like, I don't know what it's sort of like, but we leave the house and you know, you can't, it's not like I went away for 3 days last week. I took 2 pairs of shorts and 4 shirts and some underwear and a towel. But for the feast, it's a little different, isn't it? You have to pack all manner of outfits. You have to have clothes for services, festival garments. as it's called in the Bible, and yet you have to have clothes for recreation, and depending on where you're going, the climate could be anything. It could be cold, it could be hot. And you take the things that will make you comfortable. Like I decided not to take an accordion this year. Hotels frown on accordions in general, but I do take certain things. Like I take my favorite coffee cup, because if I'm going to drink coffee in my room, I'd rather not have it be in a styrofoam cup. I want it in a good porcelain cup. And I take a little bowl that sits next to my bed for things like putting in pocket change and whatever's in my pockets or little loose things. And Taya always takes an iron. For some reason, that's dear to her heart, because you never know what hotel irons are going to be. But you take enough things for survival. And it's sort of like Lego. You know, you build a set, and you have to include everything that means something to you, everything that you will need, because you're going to be there 8 to 10 days. You know what I'm talking about. You take things that are of comfort to you. You'll take a book, or you'll take your pillow, or our kids used to take stuffed animals. And part of that puts us in the mind, the temporary dwellings and the travel of being strangers on the earth, and that this is all just temporary for now, and that it's not normal for us to keep the feast in the eyes of the world right now, but someday it will be. In Jesus' own day, in his country, it was normal. The neighbors kept the feast. Jesus kept the feast. Most of the people would have kept the feast. It was only strangers and aliens who would not have kept the feast at that point. We know specifically that he did keep the Feast of Tabernacles. We don't have to turn to it, but in John 7, there's the story about his brothers giving him a hard time about not going up to the feast. And it specifically mentions the words Feast of Tabernacles. And we know that it talks about also in the book of John about the last day of the feast. And you can argue whether that would be day 7 of the Feast of Tabernacles, or what we have sometimes called the last great day, the last actual Sabbath holy day. But Jesus gave one of his most inspired sermons that is dear to us about rivers of living water. You know, it sticks in our hearts and gives us a beautiful picture of the way things that will be. So we know that he kept it. There's an interesting verse in 2 Chronicles 35 that people often refer to and say, well, you know, they didn't really keep the feast all that much. It wasn't as important to them. And the reason this comes up is in chapter 35 of 2 Chronicles, it talks about the time, the reign of King Josiah. And Josiah restored quite a bit. He wasn't a perfect human being or a perfect son of God, but he did quite a bit to turn Israel back to doing things the correct way. And this particular chapter is about them keeping the Passover. And boy, did they do it well. You read through it, and they put the ark in the temple, and they carried it correctly. And then you read down, the Levites were serving. And in verse 5, it says, stand in the holy place with a group of Levites. So they were organized, slaughter the Passover lambs. And you read in verse 7, Josiah provided for all the lay people who were there a total of 30,000 sheep and goats for the Passover offerings, and also 3,000 cattle, all from the king's own possessions. So they ate well during that Passover. It talks about music and offerings and service, and the Levites and the lambs were slaughtered and the blood was scattered, and it was all done according to the book of Moses. And they roasted the Passover lambs over fire as prescribed. They made preparations for themselves. In verse 15, talks about the musicians. The descendants of Asaph were in the places described by David. They were gatekeepers at their posts. So it was kept magnificently. And it mentions in verse 16, so that at that time, the entire service of the Lord was carried out for the celebration of the Passover and the offering of burnt offerings on the altar. Verse 17, the Israelites who were present celebrated the Passover at that time and observed the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days. So the entire country was keeping it. It was the normal thing to do. Can you imagine living in a country where all your neighbors kept the same holy days as you do, and you didn't have to explain to them every time you went to keep them. And furthermore, they were in Jerusalem doing it. We can't do that these days. I mean, that's what was proscribed. And in verse 18, this is the interesting verse. It says, the Passover had not been observed like this in Israel since the days of the prophet Samuel. And none of the kings of Israel had ever celebrated such a Passover as did Josiah with the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel who were there with the people of Jerusalem. The Passover was celebrated in the 18th year of Josiah's reign. And you think, well, that's the Passover. Did they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles? And I actually think we can conclude that that they did, and here's why. Let's just walk back in time a little bit, and back in the book of 2 Chronicles to chapter 30. And chapter 30 is the story of King Hezekiah. And King Hezekiah was also a pretty good king who turned things back. And Hezekiah also kept the Passover. And when you read, I recommend reading chapter 30 because they did it in kind of a bumbling way. They were making some of it up as they went. They were doing it right according to the law. But you read it and they weren't real certain of how to do it. But they were happy to be doing it. They were also, by the way, keeping it in the second month. This was a second Passover because they'd missed the first one. It talks in there how this came to be. And it actually says that the Levites were a bit ashamed of that. They ended up keeping the second Passover because they'd missed the first one. And so that entire chapter is devoted to the keeping of the Passover in Hezekiah's day. When we get to Josiah, you know, they say, well, nothing had been kept that way till then. But it had been kept. And when you go down to chapter 31, and verse 3, you read that Hezekiah assigned the priests and Levites to divisions, each of them according to their duties as priests of Levites, to offer burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, to minister, to give thanks, and to sing praises at the gates of the Lord's dwelling. The king contributed from his own possessions for the morning and evening burnt offerings and for the burnt offerings on Sabbaths, new moons, and appointed feasts, as written in the law of the Lord. And if they were keeping the appointed feasts, it means that they kept the yearly cycle of feasts. And there's actually some more evidence of this, because Isaiah, if you know much about the history of King Hezekiah and his life, Isaiah and Hezekiah were pals. They knew each other. They were there at the same time. And if you turn over to Isaiah and chapter 29, we'll come back to Chronicles. But if you turn over to Isaiah and chapter 29, and remember, Isaiah was a person who was well aware of what Hezekiah was doing. Okay, fingers, do it. Isaiah 29 and verse 1, Isaiah is preaching woe to Ariel, which is another name for Jerusalem. And in 29 verse 1, it says, woe to you, Ariel, Ariel, the city where David settled, add year to year and let your cycle of festivals go on, which is an interesting term. Because the festivals are a cycle, and the cycle would include all of them. And that's the one time that it's referred to that way. And Isaiah would have been around at the time when Hezekiah started keeping these holy days. So it just lets you know that Jerusalem was known as a place where this entire cycle of festivals went on. And in a similar way, it's not the only place he talks that way. In chapter 33 of Isaiah, Isaiah mentions that with pages. Chapter 33 and verse 20, it says, look upon Zion, the city of our festivals. And of course, there's much more to it there, but that's the part I want to dwell on, that the city was known as the place where the festivals were kept, not just the Passover, but the festivals. So it was done. And if you read, let's see, let's turn back to 1 Chronicles 31. sure exactly where it says it, but at some point it mentions that the Levites had been put in their place for these festivals by King David. And that's in 2 Chronicles 35. But let's turn back to 2 Chronicles 8, where Solomon is alive. And in 2 Chronicles 8, we see that even though it says that these feasts had not been kept that way since Samuel, there were provisions in place for keeping the feast. So we can't say that they weren't kept. In 2 Chronicles chapter 8 and verse 11, on the altar of the Lord that he had built in front of the portico, Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings to the Lord. And we're jumping into another story here because it talks about him bringing Pharaoh's daughter up, et cetera, et cetera. But in verse 13, it says, according to the daily requirement of offerings commanded by Moses for Sabbaths, new moons, and the three annual feasts, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles, in keeping with the ordinance of his father David. He appointed all the Levites to their jobs. And so David and Samuel and Solomon were all in on this. So when you wonder if David kept the feast, well, he set up the temple for feasts to be kept. And this is echoed in 2 Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 4, where Solomon actually, this is about, he's ordering wood. He's ordering lumber at this point. But on the invoice, he mentions, and it's... in chapter 3, he says, send me cedar logs as you did for my father David when you sent him cedar to build a palace to live in. And then verse 4, now I am about to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God and to dedicate it to him for burning fragrant incense before him, for setting out the consecrated bread regularly and for making burnt offerings every morning and evening and on the Sabbaths and new moons and at the appointed feasts of the Lord our God. This is a lasting ordinance for Israel. And it mentions, if you read further, that this was something that his father David provided. So it was set up, even though we don't have actual records. And in the book of Chronicles, you might think from Josiah keeping the feast that they weren't kept up till that point, because it mentions not since the days of Samuel. But Samuel and David were the ones who set up the service. And it was set up for all the feast days, for the entire cycle of feasts. So I just want to point out to you that it was the normal thing to do. In 1 Chronicles 23 and 31, and then we'll be done with this part. In 1 Chronicles 23 and verse 31, we have just read all the different assignments of the Levites. And in verse 31, it says, whenever burnt offerings were presented to the Lord on the Sabbaths and at the new moon festivals and at the appointed feasts, which includes the Feast of Tabernacles, they were to serve before the Lord regularly in the proper number and in the way prescribed for them. And these were things that David set up. If you read verse 6, this was entirely set up by David. Jeremiah, in the book of Lamentations, refers to the feasts in a negative way, that they're no longer being kept, that people are no longer coming up to keep the feast. And, you know, that's a little bit of evidence right there, that there was expectation that the feasts would be kept. But he refers to that more than one time. And so the feasts disappeared. But then they reappeared. And when we turn to the book of Ezra in chapter 3, right after Chronicles, when the people come back from captivity, they had kept the feasts in captivity and they keep it there. In Ezra 3, it says, when the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. And it talks about burnt offerings and what's in the law of Moses. And then in verse 4, it says, then in accordance with what is written, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles with the required number of burnt offerings prescribed for that day. So they kept it alive in the entire small country. It was the people who had come back from captivity did keep the Feast of Tabernacles. But then thousands of years of history intervened. After Jesus Christ kept them and the early church kept them, it didn't work out so well for God's holy days. They seemed to disappear and go underground, although the Jews would argue with that, wouldn't they? They always kept them alive. But in a Christian observance with Jesus Christ as the center of the meaning, they pretty much disappeared. Taya, of course, I don't know how many of you know this, Taya is an alien. My kids enjoyed telling their school friends that their mother was an alien. And she's now a citizen of the United States. But for a long time, she was a citizen of the Netherlands. And we would occasionally go back there when her parents were alive to visit. And I remember one of the most astonishing things when I was there, there were many astonishing things because Europe was completely new. Well, not quite. I was born there when my dad was in the service, but I didn't remember any of it. And you'd be walking around the city of Haarlem, which is where her father lived near, and you'd go into the old church and there'd be a sign there that said Mozart played here. And I'm thinking, I've never stood in a place where Mozart stood. And there were all kinds of things that opened my eyes like that. And of course, you know, they're perfectly normal things, but I was a provincial American and I wasn't used to traveling at that point. But one of the things I remember most, and I'm very sorry that I can't remember the exact location because it's important and I would like to find it again, was Tay and I were in the city of Haarlem somewhere. Something tells me it was the Lachen Hall, which is a museum there. But there's other museums there too. And I can't place where we were. But there was a painting that we stood in front of, and it was a painting of blonde-haired Dutch people along the harbor in the city of Haarlem. Well, that dates it because there hasn't been a harbor in Haarlem for a long time. You know, the Dutch, they move land and water around a lot. You know, just because Lake Erie is here one day doesn't mean it'll be there 100 years from now. That's the way they work. They had a harbor in Haarlem where ships from the ocean could come in and be part of that harbor. There was a naval battle, a very famous naval battle fought there. But nowadays, there aren't ships there. But when this painting was painted, there, you know, there's canals, they've walled out the ocean. It's better for all, I guess. But it dates the painting because it was at a time hundreds of years ago when there actually was a harbor in the town of Haarlem, which is in the middle of Holland. And Taya said, well, that's interesting. And I didn't know what she was talking about, but the name of the painting was Loofhuttenfest. And Loofhuttenfest is the Dutch name for the Feast of Tabernacles. So we were looking at a painting of people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And I expected to see Jews in the painting. I expected it to be a painting of Jewish culture, but it was not. It was a painting of blonde-haired Dutch people with their booths along the harbor keeping the feast. And it startled me. And at the same time, it resonated, you know, in my spirit because these people are my brothers and sisters a long time ago. So underground, it wasn't normal in their society. As a matter of fact, it was probably punishable in some ways, but the Dutch championed freedoms in ways that other people didn't. So maybe that was one of the places where they could get away with it. And here were these very Dutch people, non-Jewish people, keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. I found that thrilling. I've looked for it. I've searched for it online. You know, you look up Loofhuttenfest and you get thousands and thousands of hits on it. And so I can't find the painting, but Taya and I both saw it. And if I had been paying attention, I would have made careful note of where it was. But the fact is it was there. And I still remember that. We keep the feast knowing that our fathers kept it in their own country. And by fathers, I mean the people of Israel, whether literally in a DNA sense or symbolically in a spiritual sense. But we keep it looking to the future. We drop all the horrors and the putrid things of the world, and our world is rife with them right now. Tay and I discussed whether we would go to the feast at all this year. We decided we would because we didn't go last year. We missed it quite a bit. You can't leave everything behind in that you have to be careful. The hotel has its own rules for dealing with COVID, as does the feast, and we will abide by those. But it will be good to see people, and it will be good to play the piano and lead hymns, and on opening night to see that beautiful full moon over scenic Pewaukee, Wisconsin. That's the part of the world. We went to the feast in Oconomowoc, and we were going to send postcards home to people in Cleveland who hadn't gone to the feast. And we went to a store that seemed like a likely candidate. And the lady said, why would anyone take pictures in Oconomowoc? And I had to agree. It actually was a very pretty place with lakes and trees, but it was all flat. And, you know, it was a prosperous place, Wisconsin in the fall, produce and autumn colors and things like that. It really is a beautiful place to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's not. Well, I'll give you an example. Somebody on Facebook is driving from New England to Pewaukee to keep the feast, and they have two little kids. And the woman was groaning on Facebook because they got in the car and her two-year-old, let's say, son announced that he was going to start using the potty from that minute on. And she said, this should be an interesting trip, and I have no idea how it's going. And I was aware that she knew the feast site coordinator at Pewaukee, whose name is Devin Schultz. And I said, well, you know, when we get to Pewaukee, maybe Devin could occasionally give announcements telling us how this is going, because chances are this will be one of the most exciting things happening in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, for the Feast of Tabernacles. And wouldn't it be nice if that were true? I hope it is, that it's the people things, like a two-year-old growing up a little bit, that will be the exciting thing there. But at the same time, we put all kinds of things away, and we flee to the comfort and the safety of our hotel or our resort or our cabin or our house that we're renting or our tent, or whatever it might be, and we look to the future. Brethren, what do you think "Let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and learn his ways" is about? It's about people in the world tomorrow going up at the Feast of Tabernacles and learning his ways. They're verses that we quote this time of year. You know, Zechariah 14, very important. It talks about the nations keeping the Feast of Tabernacles after Jesus Christ has returned, and that they will be forced to do so because, of course, in the beginning, people will have to be forced to do things. After Jesus Christ returns, there will be martial law, and the people will have to do things a certain way until it becomes an absolute part of them. You know, in Isaiah 52 and verse 7, it talks about those times, because Isaiah is a book that has a lot to do with the world tomorrow, and we quote a lot from it for the Feast of Tabernacles. But in Isaiah 52 and verse 7, there's very famous poetic verses, and it says, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring the good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your Lord reigns." And this is the time of the world tomorrow, when keeping the feast will be normal for the entire world. When you read from verse 1 in chapter 52, you realize that people have been freed, that Jesus Christ has returned, and that this is that time when the good news is being proclaimed. And there's a verse that ties into this verse, and it's in Nahum, and it has just a few words that expand on this quite a bit. Nahum, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, not the easiest book to find, and it's a short one, and it's a curious book. It's mostly about Nineveh and the fall of Nineveh, which would be the Assyrians. It's not about Babylon, as many of the prophecies are, but Nahum was an interesting man, and the whole book is worth reading. But the verse that I want to look at is in chapter 1 and verse 15. I hope you can find Nahum, but I'll read it out loud anyway. And this ties in with exactly what we read in Isaiah, and Nahum was probably aware of that verse. It says, "Look there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace." And that we know. I mean, we've just heard that. And then he goes on to say, "Celebrate your festivals, O Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed." So in those days, we will actually be keeping the festivals while we're living the meaning of the festival, which will be a weird thing, but we'll get used to it. And one of the things about the Feast of Tabernacles, even though there's verse after verse after verse about the millennium that the Feast of Tabernacles pictures, is how little we know about it, really, when it comes down to details. Now, there are lots of details, and they give us enough of a picture. And you'll hear those at the Feast of Tabernacles, and I don't need to go through all those with you, although it's a beautiful thing to do. And if you have time, I mean, if you're like me, very often during these dark times, I end up turning to Isaiah 35 or Isaiah 7 or 11 or Isaiah 2 or Micah 4 that are the key verses that we turn to, because they're so inspiring and they remind us that a better world is coming. We do know that, symbolized by the Day of Atonement, we know that the ancient serpent will be bound, and that will be a time of great solemnity and fasting and coming before God. It's not about us. It's about God's story and about his spirit world. And then after that, a clean wind will blow through the earth. As the serpent is dropping down into that hole in chains, things will change. In our spirits, things will change. There will be laughter. There will be happiness. Everything that's bad will come undone. It will take some time. And the people of God, who will be spirit beings by that time, with all the resources and all the help that God can give, will rebuild the earth and restore its people. And that will be what we're alive to do. Talk about normal, it will be, the whole world will be watching us. And that restore its people is very important, because God will need people to restore, to help people. And that's why Peter refers to it as times of restitution in Acts 3, because we will be restoring, we will be rebuilding ruins. But rebuilding ruins isn't just buildings. It's also ruins of people who will be alive and encouraging them, to do their own building and to live God's way. And of course, early on, there will be a wedding supper. And that's symbolic of many things, but I believe that there will be a supper. And that's one reason we feast at the Feast of Tabernacles. Are you like me? Sunset, atonement, happy times, right? After the Day of Atonement, drink, eat, general, you get it. And I'm usually up till midnight or one at that point, because after I eat in the evening, I can't seem to go to sleep. But then I wake up the next morning and I wake up and I go, oh, can I eat? Is it okay? Is it all right? And then I go, yes, I can. And that's the way that the Feast of Tabernacles will be, because we'll have gone through all that suffering and we'll be saying ourselves, is the world still terrible? And we'll go, no, it's not. We can do all these good things. And furthermore, we're supposed to do them, and we're normal. And that's the way that it is. That's what Jesus wants us to do. And that's what the whole world wants us to do. Wedding supper is an unusual thing in that we won't actually need to eat. We'll be spirit beings. We don't need to eat. Jesus doesn't need to eat in his current state. God doesn't need to eat. But that's the time when he will again drink of the fruit of the vine. He said, it'll be a while. He said, I'm not going to do this again. But that's when it'll be, when we're all together doing that kind of thing. And the world isn't going to be an agriculture horn of plenty at that point. The world is going to be in tatters and ruins. Where's that food going to come from? Well, God will provide. We don't know how, but the tables will groan under the magnificent food and drink that will be served to us as the bride of Christ at that time. Just as at the end of Jesus' own temptation, when he recommitted himself back to God, it said angels fed him. God provided. Humans didn't provide the food, but God did, and he can and he will. And eventually the whole world will come around, and we think, well, yes, Israel, Judah will be wonderful. We'll be part of that. But one of the most startling passages in the Bible is in Isaiah 19. And let's turn there, because when I read this, I have to recalibrate all my little fantasies about the world tomorrow and about what it will be like working under Jesus Christ in those days. And this entire chapter, if you're in Isaiah at 19, mine has a heading that says a prophecy about Egypt. And it is a prophecy about Egypt. And you've read enough of the Bible to know that Egypt is generally the bad guy. If the word Egypt is in the story, Egypt is generally the bad guy. It's not people who lived God's way. They were either the enemies or the people that you had to deal with in some way, and they were a a home of, I don't use the word paganism very much, but it's the only word that fits. They had many gods who were not the true God, and they were counter to God's way of life. Well, you can read the whole story and how terrified the Egyptians are in verse 16 and 17, but then in verse 18, things turn, and you realize we're talking about a different time, that this isn't just Egypt being punished in the dark days of the end time. Verse 18, in that day, five cities in Egypt will speak the language of Canaan. Now, what? I thought Canaan was long gone, but anyway, the languages of Canaan are very much alive at that point, and they will swear allegiance to the Lord Almighty. One of them will be called the City of Destruction, one of those cities, and that's not a sure translation. One of the translations for that verse is Heliopolis, which historically is a, you know, a city of temples and a center of worship for the Egyptians, and maybe that's why it's called the City of Destruction, because so much will have to be destroyed and changed. In verse 19, in that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the heart of Egypt and a monument to the Lord at its border. What? This is definitely world tomorrow material, folks. There's no other time it can happen. It hasn't happened yet. It will be a sign and a witness to the Lord Almighty in the land of Egypt when they cry out to the Lord because of their oppressors. And that's interesting all by itself, because if this is the world tomorrow, where do the oppressors come from? Well, it won't be a perfect world. You know, that's why we need martial law to start out with, because not everybody will be on board. Anyway, because of their oppressors, he will send them a savior and a defender, and he will rescue them. And who do you think that savior and defender will be? So the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians, and in that day they will acknowledge the Lord. They will worship with sacrifices and grain offerings. They will make vows to the Lord and keep them. These are physical people that we're talking about, but it's in the world tomorrow. The Lord will strike Egypt with a plague. He will strike them and heal them, if necessary, when they don't keep the Feast of Tabernacles. They will turn to the Lord, and he will respond to their pleas, and he will heal them. And then verses 23 through 25 are just amazing. As a matter of fact, every time I read them, I think, did I really read that? Is that possible? Because it says, in that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Now, Assyria, remember the book of Nahum was all about Assyria. Assyria is bad guys. Assyria is enemies. Assyria is people who destroyed the nation of Israel, the northern kingdoms. The Assyrians will go to Egypt and the Egyptians to Assyria, because there'll be a highway from one to the other. You know what's right in the middle of Egypt and Assyria? We know where Egypt is. Assyria we're a little vague on, but we know where Nineveh was, where its capital was. You can't get from one to the other without going through what we call Palestine, Israel, Jerusalem. You have to go that way. And so they'll be also linked with Israel. The Egyptians and the Assyrians will worship together. In that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. And it doesn't say Israel will be the first. It says Israel will be the third. Now, to me, that means there's three. They're pretty equal. They're one of three. But who are these three? It's Israel, Egypt, and Assyria, and they're all called a blessing on the earth. This is after some of the wonderful things have happened in the world tomorrow. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance." So at this time, not only will keeping the feast be normal, it'll be the thing that you don't have to explain to your neighbors, but the whole world will be getting on board. And I can only think that these three will be, you know, in God's eyes, they're beloved people. They're blessed people. And I don't think of Assyria and Egypt as being that way. I think of the world tomorrow as being a very Israel-centric life. You know, Jerusalem, yes, we're in charge. Rod of iron, well, you know, we rule. And that's not the way it will be. The whole world, I like to think one people at a time, that eventually there won't be three, but there will be many, many peoples who are also that way in God's eyes. Process that. It's just going to take you a while, that Assyria and Egypt will be equal to Israel in God's eyes at that point. God's way will be normal. You would think that we wouldn't have to keep the festivals at that point, because we'll be living them. But we will. That's one of the things that we know, is that the festivals will be kept. We will keep them as glorious spirit beings. And I can only imagine what celebrations can be like for spirit beings. You've seen fantastic fireworks and pageantry and things. Well, who knows, when the whole universe is your stage, who knows the glories that we'll take part in at that point. And we will keep them in the company of people who were very much physical. And so they will be keeping the feast the way that we do now. They'll be eating, they'll be listening, they'll be learning, they'll be building their booths. Will they all go up to Jerusalem? I don't know. That seems logistically impossible, but so much of the feast seems impossible of the world tomorrow, and also impossible to God. What does that mean? You know, so we'll learn. And then in another 1,000 years, we will keep them again, but we'll keep them in the company of people who lived before. And I can't even think of that. You know, keeping the feast next to my mother and my father, that's just so weird to me. They were tolerant of the feast, but in no way did they want any part of it. But it'll happen. You know, Taya and I, we don't speak of this very often, but we had a third child at one point. He was actually stillborn, and I don't know how that works in the world tomorrow, but he was a full-term baby. And sometimes I wonder, will he be keeping the feast? Will I get to keep it next to him? And I, you know, I can't go down that path very far because I get kind of emotional about it, but there will be emotions for everybody at that point. It will be just a beautiful time keeping it with Leonardo da Vinci and Attila the Hun and, you know, all these people. And they may choose not to do it, but for a while they will have to. God's way will be normal, and we need to keep his feast now, knowing that it will be. We need to keep his feast now with determination and knowing that we're the normal ones. And I know that's a sign of mental illness to say, well, we're the normal ones. You know, the rest of the world is. But we are. We're the ones doing it right. And we need to keep the feast that way, knowing that it's the right thing to do. And even though it's only a tiny segment of the world, keep it right now. And the rest of the world thinks it's weird. It's everybody else who is not normal. I want to leave you with a video, which Joe has graciously gotten ready to go. This video was the feast welcome video in the year 2017. I just want to talk about it a little bit. And I'm not playing this because I wrote the music, although I did. And I'm very proud to have written the music for it. But I didn't know that my music was being used for this video. This video was a true international effort. The piano player was a woman named Fiona Shipke, who lives in Brisbane. She worked together with a man named Jeff Robertson, whom you will hear singing. But he needed a good violin player, and he used a violinist who grew up in Scotland, but actually lived in Paris. He just sent him the part, and they recorded it, and they put it together. And some of the other contributions were the same way. And then it was all sent to Cincinnati, where other people worked on it as well. And you'll hear children's voices in it. And when I first heard these children's voices, I thought, I know those children, because they're kind of relatives. They're not. There's no DNA connection between me and the children you will hear on it, but they are my daughter's nieces and nephews. She married their uncle, and the kids you will hear are kind of part of our family in a church network way. You know how it works. It's a very tangled web, complicated in a good way. This was a great surprise to us. We were in Brisbane, Australia for that feast, and I did not know that this video existed. And I was sitting next to the man who sings in the video and had put the video together. And when they played it, of course, I just melted into a pile of not worth very much stuff. And I recovered after a while, but I thought it was so beautiful. And the reason I want to play it today is because I think it's one of the best things we have ever produced about the Feast of Tabernacles. On my Facebook page, I don't put much about the church, and when I do, it's in code. I remember one Feast of Trumpets I put, happy you know what to you know who. So I'm very cute about it, you know, because more than half of my Facebook friends are not Church of God people who would be keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. But when I saw this, I was so proud of it and so unashamed and so confident about it that the positive way that it presented the Feast of Tabernacles in a way that I have never seen it presented before. And so I proudly put it on my Facebook page, and I was happy to do it, and I did not apologize. It's a look back and a look forward. It includes some of the riches of our past keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. You'll see the campus in Pasadena, and you'll see the campgrounds in Big Sandy. You'll see big choirs. You'll see old pictures of the way that we did things in those times. You'll see lots of people. You'll be amused if you've forgotten that there are Cleveland Links, that some of you sitting here today, you're going to see yourselves in this video, because there were a number of congregations who contributed footage to this project. And nowadays, you know, the video also looks forward. And now feast sites are smaller than they used to be. And we have all kinds of things wreaking havoc with our plans, the biggie of which is a teeny, teeny virus that we can't see, but that affects our whole world. But every year we keep the feast, we are one year closer to Jesus Christ returning and fulfilling all that it portends. You can keep a good feast at home. We did, and I understand that people have to do that at times. But it's intended to be a gathering of the people of God. Right now, we keep it in a limited, small way that the world hardly notices. But one day, it will be completely normal. It will be more than normal. It will be the right thing to do. And with that, I'm going to sit down and let you enjoy the video. Happy Feast of Tabernacles!
How I love thy law, Lord, joy to me its truths afford. In its light I wisely go to battle every foe. Sweeter are thy words to me than all other words can be. Safe I walk thy truth, my life, hating falsehood, loving right. Thy commandments in my heart, truth and wisdom can impart. To my eyes thy precepts show more than my teachers know. Sweeter are thy words to me than all other words can be. Safe I walk thy truth, my life, hating falsehood, loving right.
Celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles for 7 days after you have gathered the produce of your threshing floor and your wine press. Be joyful at your festival. You, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levites, the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns. For 7 days, celebrate the festival to the Lord your God at the place the Lord will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you and all your harvest and all the work of your hands, and your joy will be complete.
Many people shall come and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Happy Feast of Tabernacles to you. I want to thank you for joining us here and making this festival an enriching experience for us all. We're here to worship God, to learn, and to rejoice. We're here to spend time with our families and friends and strengthen those relationships. Our awesome God has provided this wonderful opportunity. Let's make the most of it. We're also here to soberly reflect on the brokenness of our world as it currently is. The creation looks forward to the day when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay. For we know that all creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. This has also been a year of groaning through personal trials. We await deliverance and transformation. We will be learning about that here at the Feast of Tabernacles, so that we can understand and stay strong. I hope you make the most of the time you have at this feast. Don't let a day go by without connecting with one of your brothers and sisters in Christ. Try to make it a personal goal this feast to meet someone new and start a new friendship. Don't let a day go by without opening your Bible and soaking in God's Word. Don't let a day go by without praying to your Father in heaven. Finally, though there is much to reflect on that sobers and humbles us, don't let a day go by without truly rejoicing in God's wonderful plan to heal and restore His world and the people He has made. Have a wonderful Feast of Tabernacles.
On the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water."
While my heart thy word obeys, I am kept from evil ways. From thy law with thee to guide, I never turn aside. I never turn aside. Let my heart pour forth with praise. Let me sing of thy great ways. Of thy word I stand in awe. Oh, how I love thy law. Sweeter are thy words to me than all other words can be. Safe I walk thy truth, my life, hating falsehood, loving right.
They shall not hurt nor destroy, and on my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea.